I'm Matt Hoffman, an educator at the National Museum of American History, and this is History Explorer, a podcast that lets you investigate questions about history along with our staff. Today we're going to follow one of our curators' research journeys into fraternal orders, and we don't mean college fraternities. Often incorporating aspects of ritual and secrecy, fraternal orders are voluntary associations of men and women that date back to the early 18th century. You may or may not have heard of them. The Freemasons, the Independent Order of the Odd Fellows, the Knights of Pythias, or even some slightly less mysterious organizations that emerged in the 20th century, like the Lions Club or Rotary. Tim Winkle is a curator responsible for the museum's Fraternal Orders collection. I asked him to tell us a little bit about their history and why people joined.
Freemasonry begins officially in London when four lodges form a Grand Lodge in 1717. From that first Grand Lodge spawned, at least as far as America is concerned, Freemasonry in America, which comes during the 1730s. It slowly picks up pace until about the time of the Revolution, when it actually, there's quite a lot of membership, and after the Revolution and into the early 19th century, Freemasonry is very important, and frankly, the only fraternal organization. Then another English import, the Odd Fellows, comes over in the early 19th century, and the 19th century really sees an explosion of fraternal organizations. And certainly by the end of the 19th century, which is sometimes called the golden age of fraternal societies, there's dozens, if not many dozens, on the American scene. Essentially, and especially again in the 19th century, the importance of a fraternal organization is as not only for community and for fellowship, as it were, but also for a social safety net. So many organizations acted as a form of life insurance or mutual aid society, where the dues you paid in and the money you used to subscribe to the organization were often pooled and then doled out, things like that. And of course, this is all before the New Deal and before the creation of the sort of social welfare system that we know today. Now you don't need to belong to an organization such as this to ensure that essentially your family is okay after you pass away. But you know, in those times, your job did not offer that kind of security. You certainly didn't have health insurance, for instance. So there was a very practical reason for joining many sorts of these fraternal societies. Their numbers have diminished in proportion to the need to belong to them for that sort of practical reason, to the point where many are, you know, I would frankly say almost shadows of their former selves.
Now that we've learned some basic history about fraternal orders, let's look at a particular object from the collection that yielded an interesting story.
Was essentially an engraved silver coin that probably dated from the 18th century. From the inscription, we knew who had engraved it, who had made it and engraved it, what Masonic lodge it belonged to, because that's also on the engraving, and there was a set of initials on it. But we knew it was an important piece, and one that when I took it on, I hoped I could find out more about. Now, the object is called a Mark medal, and I won't bore people with the details, but a Mark medal is something you receive in the first part of a degree of masonry that is called Royal Arch, basically. And what it is meant to be is it draws from medieval stone masons their mason's mark that you would see in a stone of a cathedral or a castle. You know, the individual master mason would carve his mark into it to show that, you know, he had worked there. And you could even see them here. There was marks in the, you know, stones of the foundation of the Capitol building, for instance, in the White House. You know, they do turn up in American tradition as well. So the idea is that you pick a unique mark and that is your, you know, that's your symbol, and that it's engraved, at least at this period, it was engraved on a silver token that you then wore about your neck on a sash. But we didn't know anything about it except who made it and what lodge it had come from, but we didn't have a period or a person. But we were lucky enough that there were initials on it, and the initials were GA. So we had that to go with. We knew that the lodge was from New York. It's a lodge called Holland Lodge. And we knew that the maker was a man named Peter Rushton Maverick, because he had engraved Brother Maverick, B.R. Maverick, on one side of the token. So we knew those things. Dating it was difficult because, again, He's active from the 1770s, especially the 80s, the 90s, tapering off after the turn of the century. Holland Lodge starts well within that period, so it's very difficult to date there. So what we really had to go with was the initials. And so it was a case of trying to figure out who had these initials. And frankly, we caught a very lucky break, because within Peter Rushton Maverick's lifetime, there's only two members of that lodge with those initials. And it's a man named George Anthon and his son, who was also named George Anthon. No one else had those initials. And we know this because, being a very old and important lodge, they've published a lot of their own history. So then it was a question of whether it was his son or whether it was him. And really, it could only be George Anthon. His life dates and his activity in Masonry could only really match up to Peter Rushton Maverick's most productive period. That's made more complicated by the fact that Peter Rushton Maverick had a son called Peter Maverick. So we're dealing with two people with sons with the same names who all, the one son is also a Mason, and Maverick's son is also an engraver and a very famous one in his own right. So it does make those kind of things tricky, but knowing the person's story behind it makes it so much more valuable, frankly. Now, George Anthon has quite an interesting story behind him. So now that we know who it is, we can try and then explore who the person was. And in this case, we do know George Anthon's story. And again, this is through works that were published by his family in the 19th century and through census records, for instance, and different things, and from the lodge's own records. But Anthon was a German who studied to be a doctor and eventually moved to Holland, to the Netherlands, where he joined the Dutch West India Company. At some point, actually, having been captured by British pirates, he found his way to America and made his way into the British Army. And so Anthon actually served as the physician in the far-off, at the time, post of Detroit from the 1760s through the American Revolution and into, I think, he finally leaves Detroit in about 1786. So he has this lifetime of military service, of frontier medicine. He's serving the Native American population in Detroit, as well as the British garrison there. And when he returns to New York, he has quite a large family, and he becomes a trustee of what would eventually become Columbia University, and becomes a respected medical figure in New York City. And this is 1780s, 1790s. He dies in, I believe, 1815. I think when you look at any community organization, we tend to have a strange perspective. We often think the things that exist now have always been that way. Perhaps they're slightly diminished or slightly changed, but they've always been there. To reference one of my other collections, your local fire department, perhaps in your town or your city 150 years ago, it would have been all volunteers. They would have formed groups that were very similar to fraternal organizations. And there might have even been rivalries between these groups, and they would have acted very much like mutual aid societies as well. They would have had benefits to their members and all that kind of thing. Very different picture. It's always worth questioning and digging deeper into the organizations, the everyday organizations that we see around us, and to look at these organizations as history in a sort of microcosm, because you can often see larger changes reflected in small groups of people. You can start to question why they changed and what forced these changes or helped these changes along. These types of organizations, these community organizations, because they're usually so good at keeping records, they can be very useful in tracking those kind of things if you're asking the right questions. So again, changes in membership size, membership demographic, membership in terms of what the types of members you're seeing. Are you seeing a shift in class, a shift in profession? Did this organization die out where you live, and why? So it becomes a real lens that you can track larger changes. And there's lots of aspects that act as a lens, and this just happens to be one. You'll see that in how your police force was formed, how your fire service was created. Do you have a local scout group? When did that scout group form? Do you have a 4-H club? What's the history of 4-H? How does it reflect, larger themes in American agriculture, at the time it was founded? There's all types of things that these groups can tell you. And I've never really seen any that don't open up to inquiry. And I would hope, you know, any such organization would be happy to assist in any sort of research that you know, is using them as a, you know, as a key piece in the puzzle.
Thanks for listening to the History Explorer podcast. And thanks to curator Tim Winkle for taking the time to talk with us today. To hear more History Explorer podcasts, visit americanhistory.si.edu/podcasts or simply subscribe to us on iTunes. Music for this episode from the Underscore Orchestra, which you can find at theunderscoreorchestra.com. This podcast is made possible through a generous grant from the Verizon Foundation.